everybody, to the stand-up. We have quite the list today, and we're going to be talking about quite the topic. It has been all over Twitter. The new Next.js clone from Cloudflare, VyNext. And with us, we have Dane from Cloudflare, CTO, correct? We have Steve. Sorry, I do not know your position. And Dylan, of course, most people here know Dylan, streamer extraordinaire. If you guys could take a moment, maybe introduce yourselves a little bit better, that would probably be the best.
That would be better. That would be good, actually.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on. Dane Connect, I'm the Cloudflare CTO. Been at Cloudflare for a little over 14 years and trying not to break the internet every day.
Okay, that's nice. Reasonable. Yeah, because when Cloudflare goes down, so does the internet.
I'm Steve Faulkner. I'm the Director of Engineering for Workers, Containers, Agents SDK, a bunch of other stuff. About 100 people, so responsible for a bunch of our like developer platform products. I've been only for 2 years, so Dane's got a few on me.
I guess we're going in order of seniority. Dylan, go ahead.
Yes, I am the least senior by far here. I'm an engineer at Cloudflare. I've been here for 4 or 5 months now, and working on one of our AI and agent teams. And as chat knows, I do a lot of streaming, so.
Also one of the founders of TweetMesh and The Real Humans. So, I mean,
true. Dylan Moskowitz.
He was definitely not moonlighting, to be clear. Definitely not. There was nothing during that time period we were involved in.
All right. So I think there's a lot of ways we could introduce this topic. So I think it'd probably be best just for everybody kind of getting up to speed. Why don't you kind of give like a pitch of what is VyNext and what was like the goal for you going into this experiment?
I mean, the goal is pretty much everything we do. We do it for customers. It's, you know, for almost 5 years now, it's been one of the biggest requests is how do you make Next easier to deploy on Cloudflare? And, you know, we recognize we have a slightly different architecture. You know, we have region Earth. Deploy once, goes everywhere. That applies different constraints to how you can build things on Cloudflare. I mean, there's always going to be trade-offs. We understand that Next was built for more traditional environments, and no issue with that. We've always been trying to figure out ways to make it easier to deploy on Cloudflare because that's what the customers are asking for. Actually, last summer, Steve pitched the idea that let's have one of the interns just try this. He kind of had the idea that. You know, the Vite surface area with the Next APIs actually could work. He thought it through a little bit, and we brought on an intern who, he gave it a good shot. An intern's only here for 3 months. He got a lot of the PageRouter surface area done, we kind of put that on the shelf because we realized it was going to be quite an investment to actually.
A lava lamp shelf or a different one?
I don't know. Probably more in Steve's garage.
Got it.
Yeah, and then I guess Steve, two months ago was I guess in his garage and said, "Hey, I have an electric screwdriver now. Let's see if I can give it a go and finish this project out."
Teach, production's down.
I don't concern myself with such matters.
What do you mean production doesn't concern you?
I've shipped 37, nay, 38 features today. Teach always makes the mess, and I always clean it up. I'm better than them.
I don't have to be a janitor. Someone has to be the adult around here.
Who is that?
It's me, your West LA godfather.
John Carmack?
What? No, it's me, Trash.
Oh. Wait! Are you here to finally get management to understand software?
What? I'm a West LA godfather, not a miracle worker.
Oh. Then why are you here?
I'm here to tell you about Seer by Sentry, the world's first AI debugger that actually has access to all of your logs, stack traces, code, commit history, and more. Code breaks, but you can get the fixed faster with Seer.
Who are you talking to?
What? Back to the stand-up.
Build with AI, fix with Sentry.
Yeah, it was really, for me, it was all about AI, right? I mean, Next and sort of applying it to Vite was the problem that I ended up picking, but it was more about like, how can I push out AI in all these ways and these limits? And can I just take it further than I've taken any other project? And so it's just sort of the right problem at the moment.
Can we go back to the intern for a quick second? What was the intern's reaction when you're just like, hey, make Next.js for Cloudflare, no mistakes? Like, what was that experience like?
He was excited. It was one of our, you know, interns is more ambitious than most, and he really wanted something big and juicy to try. And so I said, hey, here's a big juicy thing. You know, see how far you get. And honestly, like, we scoped it initially just to pages. I didn't think he would even get to touch AppRouter before, you know, 3 months. And he made a decent amount of progress on pages. Like, it did kind of work, at least the basics. And so, yeah, it at least showed me that there was something there, like a thread to pull. And then it was sort of like, okay, now AI is here and can actually, you know, do the rest of the work.
Wait, at that level, okay, so how do you make the decision to put something on the shelf at that point? Because you have a somewhat working version of it. You have a bunch of customers wanting to use it, but you have to maintain it afterwards. Like, at what point, what was the line that said, okay, we're willing to maintain things at this point? Because obviously you did not go forward with the interns. Work.
Yeah. First off, this thing was just Pages Router, right? Which is, you know, there's a bunch of people out there that still are on Pages Router and love Pages Router and want to keep using it. So, you know, I could see a world where we would have just like done a Pages Router only version. But again, this is where AI just kind of keeps coming back into the story. If you go look at the VNext repo, we maintain it with AI, right? We have AI bots that are doing triaging. We have AI bots that are reviewing all the PRs. We have AI bots that are doing security reviews. We have now AI bots that track the Next.js repo and then open up issues back into our repo where we find commits that are relevant. So it's like part of why we can keep doing this is because of AI too. It's why we could do it, and then it's why we can keep doing it.
So. I mean, in some ways, the fact that we're also doing this as open source, it's a kind of a bigger experiment on how you make open source work in the AI world. You know, a lot of open source maintainers are really struggling with all the pull requests to have to deal with the comments and, you know, is there a more sustainable way? And so far, this has been pretty sustainable. Like, I think there's over 50 committers who actually, when we say they're committers, it means they wrote a plan for an agent to implement something. You know, they're still using all AI implemented code, but, you know, they're still committers and they're helping move the project forward. But then, you know, then you have their agents talking to the GitHub comments. And so, you know, we don't have it all figured out, but I feel like there's a model here where, you know, you're applying AI in any sustainable way to open source. And that's kind of the beauty of open source.
I had a so sort of like related to that in terms of, you know, so I did a lot of stuff with NeoVim and like maintaining a fork that like still cared about, like we were trying to still make it so that it wasn't like completely different experience compared to using Vim, still applying like patches and a bunch of other stuff. I think actually, you know, NeoVim is experimenting with some stuff in some of the same vein of figuring out like, hey, how do we not have to spend all of our time like merging over patches from Vim, you know, like some people that's like their thing. Dylan, I think, you know, like there's a few people who you're like, how does this person even do all of this? It's crazy. But like how, you know, deciding like, okay, we're going to have this fork and everything. Like, how do you decide what features from Next make sense to go into this? How do you, you know, triage what things are most important, etc.? Like, because that part for me is the really difficult part about like having a fork of something is not so much like, hey, we have this new piece of code, but you also need to, you know, decide how it continues to be a drop-in replacement, is a drop-in replacement for certain aspects or what. I'm interested on that, like part of the maintainership.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of how you define the mission of it, right? Like, yeah, the mission is it's not really a fork. This is a, you know, it's just the Next API service, the official API service, put over a different runtime, really, the V kind of runtime. So we actually are not accepting pull requests and feature requests for things that fall out of that. We are following Next completely. Versus today, we launched MDash, which is I would call that, you know, probably name these different kind of forks. So, you know, I call that more of a spiritual fork of WordPress, where, you know, it can import WordPress. It looks a lot like WordPress in a lot of ways, but, you know, it has a lot of unique things that go off the traditional path, and it, you know, and I think its roadmap over time will diverge diverge more like a traditional fork. You know, I mean, there's a long history of how, you know, different forks evolve. Like, you know, WebKit came out of out of Linux ecosystem, and then Chrome obviously made it, you know, Blink, and sometimes they diverge. And I mean, honestly, if we didn't have forks, we would still be all on IE probably, right? You know, or the Node's ecosystem, right? In that case, Node, you know, obviously had the fork to IO, and it, you know, it made some points, and it actually brought the community back together in a better place when it kind of reemerged back together. So I mean, in general, I think it's all healthy. I think it just, you can do it at such a different rate and cost today that that's really the biggest part of the story.
What are you guys going to do if you have to kind of compete against some sort of surface area that goes against what you're doing? Because I know you made, like, building was one of the big things where you made building work better because it doesn't build every single artifact if they have some sort of static thing. Instead, it analyzes your traffic and it's like, hey, we're only going to build 10% of your assets because if we do that, we're going to cover 99% of traffic. It's super fast and your build time's not 45 minutes. What are there things they could add that you would have to say no to? Like, is there a world where Vinext is actually a different fork? It no longer maintains the same surface area? Or are you, like, hard on same surface area always?
I would say right now we're hard on same surface area always, right? I'm not trying to create, like, drastically different things. I would say, like, never say never, though, right? Like, I mean, we're going to see where this goes. If they introduce something that completely, you know, is, like, against what, you know, like, we want to do, or against, you know, maybe, like, what we consider a best practice for architecture, I mean, we'll consider it, right? It's going to really depend on the thing and what is needed. I'll be honest, I've been surprised how many people have come in asking for us to fix bugs in Next or things that Next has said it won't do, right? There's actually a pretty active discussion right now, a feature from Next 9 that apparently a lot of people really liked that they deprecated. There's a bunch of people
it's
that
like
want
eight versions ago or something
yeah,
like
it
that,
is
right?
Yeah.
Right.
What is the feature? Like, what is the request going on?
They switched from Git initial props, which ran on the client and the server, to Git server side props. I think I'm hopefully getting the details right there. And a lot of people still like Git initial props, right, for various reasons. So there's a vocal community that wants us to add Git initial props. I don't know if we'll do that one since it's deprecated and we're still trying to keep true to Next, at least Next 16, like where Next is at today. But it's the kind of example of things that are coming in that people are asking for. So there's, like, smaller ones, like little behavioral tweaks where somebody maybe says, oh, Next should have always done it this way. Will you just do it that way instead? But so far, we've been really holding the line of, like, let's just do it the way Next does, because we want it to just, you know, match one for one.
So there's a kind of a funny law that in programming, we have a lot of laws in programming, right? And one of them is Hiram's law, which is effectively that the internals, there will eventually be features that aren't documented that you rely on, that people rely on. Have you ran into any Hiram's law that's like a non-documented feature, but just the way that it was programmed that people are like, hey, this doesn't work. Like Vercel, I can launch this on Vercel, but I can't do it on Cloudflare because of some funny internal if statement that you just don't have captured.
I'd say some of that's coming from the community packages, right? So things that are people have plugged into the Next internals, right? Like other vendors, other people supplying, like, you know, things that plug into your Next.js app automatically and hook things in. That's where we've probably hit the most friction, is that they either were knowingly plugging into undocumented Next internals, or they didn't know they were, and now they're finding out, right, when they try to come use vNext.
Like when someone imports, like, do not import this or you will be fired or something like that, and they're like,
yes.
Well, bro, but you guys aren't supporting do not import this or you will be fired. That's literally the key to my workflow.
You'll see it if somebody imports from Next dist, right? Like that's like in Next X, you know, internal distribution.
Oh,
right?
Nice.
That's where they usually end up into trouble. So
do you guys support importing from Vinext/dist, or is that just something that you're like, no, we will not do internals?
So right now, no, we have not done it yet. But I, again, never say never. Dane said at the beginning, like, we're doing what customers want. This whole thing is about, like, how can we give people a better experience running Next.js, like, everywhere and on Cloudflare. And so if there's enough demand for something, we'll at least think about it.
The spike on new users that day was, you know, one of the biggest one-day spikes ever. Like, I mean, you can see that there's pent-up demand. And, you know, that's why we do things here.
What's the, like, you know, obviously right now it can't do literally everything. What's the path, or like what would make you guys feel like it moves out of like an experiment into something that's like not experimental, or you would say is like, oh, we feel good about this?
We're working through that now. So probably the big one you already mentioned is proper pre-rendering for everything. I mean, some people still want that, right? They don't want the percentage pre-rendering. And so we've got some stuff going on right now for that. There's some ways, just some like a lot of little like things that Next does a little differently. And we're trying to figure out like, do we want to do it a little differently? You know, some of these things don't map cleanly between Vite and TurboPack, right? So there's stuff where we're trying to still work out some details. It's all small stuff where like a hard navigation might happen in our case, but it wouldn't happen in Next because, you know, they do some sort of like soft navigation, you know, hijack into what the browser is going on. So there's a few examples of that, but it really mostly works, right? Like if you look at like the bulk of what people are, you know, doing with Next, and not sort of the long tail of new API features, but, you know, routing and hydration, server-side rendering, all works.
I'm interested a little bit in sort of just like, you know, you said a lot of it is, you know, people with their AI agents. Like, I'm interested in knowing, like, how do you guys manage that from like a, hey, it's a fast moving thing, we're experimenting, people are running this in production, how do we make sure we don't just like inslopify our entire like app or release like, yeah, I mean, I know that it's all the rage these days to add 37K lines of code a day. And you're like, if you're not doing that, you're getting left behind. But I'm wondering how you guys, you know, prevent like that situation from happening from some of the stuff you said at the beginning.
Yeah, so I'll give a couple examples. Yep. I mean, number one, that we rely on the tests, right? The, you know, we ported a bunch of the Next.js tests, not all of them because they didn't all make sense to port, but we ported a huge suite of tests and we're still porting more. So it's just having that confidence that these tests are doing what they think they do. So we're not breaking users. We have end-to-end tests, unit tests, and then we kind of have a whole suite now of like smoke tests that we run against production deployments. The other thing too is there's been a couple times where I've had to say, sort of go in and unsloppify things with AI. So probably the best example is that there was a part that was about a 2,000 line template string in there that was like a lot of logic got like, you know,
nice,
like clobbered into this thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna lie, it was pretty bad. And I just sat down one day and I was like, we cannot have this in here. This is unmaintainable for humans and AI. Mm-hmm. So I spent the weekend kicking off a bunch of PRs just bit by bit. Got stuff out of there, split it out into its own modules. And so like just going through and finding where the slop happens and then sort of saying, no, I'm going to spend time de-slopifying that part.
I've actually seen that exact thing many, many times, even using Cloudflare like Hono, just saying like, hey, AI agent, let's go build out this thing. It's just like, gotcha, dog. It's just one, it loves giant HTML strings or JavaScript strings. And then it becomes impossible to start debugging because then it's just this crazy cycle of, how do you actually know? It's tough. It's a tough world.
It's no linting, no type checking. It's just like the Wild West, yeah. So
Interpolating strings. Yeah, my favorite way to do this. This is why I write full stack JavaScript, is so I can throw away JSX and I can use template strings.
Steve, I actually have a good question for you because like you probably.
Hey, Dylan, you're a guest here. You're not an interviewer. What the heck? Listen, no, I'm just kidding.
This is
okay,
my.
Go ahead, Dylan.
Now.
We'll allow it.
We talked about this a little bit early when you started the project, but I wanted to follow up and ask the question again now that you've like had, you probably have more experience than most people in driving a large code base with exclusively AI and like finding slop, like this template string literal that you were just talking about. Like, have you found good strategies for like building tooling for either the repo CI/CD or like harnesses to like prevent the same mistakes over and over again? Or like what are like your tips for like there's a whole conversation to be had about how to properly do like agentic development. Like I'm very much in the camp and like I want to keep my work small, I want to keep it isolated, and I want to review every single line of code that goes in. But like Vinex being like a good experimental repo and like how can we like really maximize this, like what have you found to work on putting good guardrails on the AI and getting good results?
I mean, I mentioned already test, linting, stuff around, well, formatting matters a little less, but I think it still helps, right? So some of the diffs aren't, you know, ridiculous. So we've put a lot of effort into that. I would say once a week, I just go ask AI, like, hey, what's the sloppiest part of this code base and how can we fix it, right? I think that's an important part. We also, I do have a scheduled process that updates agents.md every few days. So it goes and looks through PRs, looks through the comments on those PRs where we had AI, you know, finding stuff and saying, okay, how can we make sure we don't, you know, make these same mistakes again? This stuff is pretty wild. Like every time I think I'm like, oh, I'm kind of hitting the limit. This is like, it can't figure itself out. The answer just kind of seems to be throw more AI at it. And it sort of like rescues itself right from the brink. I don't know. So,
and this has sort of become like a lab for us for, you know, how we do things internally. I mean, internally, you know, we are still very much in the, you know, engineers write the code with AI, they commit it, and, you know, much more traditional still, you know, pull request process via human. But with AI assisted, of course. And, you know, we have strict rules like no vibe coding. You have to read every line of your code and you basically attest to it when you do it. But, you know, we obviously see that things in this project where we want to apply internally and try to think of how you do the guardrails, not on a, you know, a project that has one main maintainer and versus like, you know, a 2000 person engineering org. And the things that we found really work well there is, you know, there's linting, but there's also, you know, how you build. And so, like, we've been working internally a lot on what we call, like, the engineering codex, which is a set of RFCs that get kind of rolled up into a kind of like a 10 commandments of a lot more than 10 on how you build everything. And then, you know, an AI reviewer internally doesn't just do a security review, doesn't just do a, you know, performance review. It actually goes over the codex and says, you know, is this how you build things at Cloudflare, and kind of reviews those. And some of those things are things like, you know, kind of Steve, you know, no long HTML strings. You know, and obviously those are the things that it would catch and hopefully kind of put the AI back to the PR reviewer back in, you know, back at it to review it. But you can see that, you know, those things can kind of get applied to more pure agentic workflow in the future as well, to those kind of guardrails. But I mean, you have to treat the AI like as if it was another engineer. I mean, AI is kind of just making us all clean up a lot of the tech debt that we had, where our readmes weren't up to date, our comments weren't good, our code wasn't structured great. You know, AI wants the same things as, you know, any human developer wants when they come into a project, really. So,
realistically, you're obviously approaching Vinex much different than you're approaching everything you do internally, right? I forget the name of the big edge. You had a name for it. It was in Lua for version 1. It's now in Rust for version 2. I read so many of your blogs at this point. I know there's a name for it, but would you be okay with people trying to take the same approach that you see in Vinext into that area?
I think today probably not quite, just cuz I mean but I think you'd have to a whole different set of test suites just the level of detail of writing something that is so specific to our hardware, so that we get, you know, every CPU cycle is, you know, perfectly timed. So it's the only way we can run at our scale and offer so many free things is if everything is kind of perfectly aligned there. That takes a lot of innovation I think the AI is still good at how you copy existing patterns and replace it. I still haven't seen AI, you know, invent a new algorithm or invent a new way where, like, you know, building FL, we also have patches that go all the way into the kernel that change how IPv4 hash lookups happen, right? Like, AI wouldn't know that in order to build this, we also need to do a kernel patch to change how we, you know, do these socket lookups, right? So, I mean, I think the level of complexity and is a little different in those cases.
Do you think any of it also is different? Like, for this one, a lot of it is there's already a well-defined, like, shape and stuff that you're trying to match against versus, like, hey, we're starting a brand-new greenfield project. Like, I've seen it go off the rails a lot more often when I'm like, hey, like, let's just write this. And I say, like, okay, go. And it spins for a little bit and it comes back. I'm like, this is so bad. I can't believe that this generated this, so I'm wondering, like, your thoughts on, is this like a particular kind of repo where it's special that this kind of strategy would work compared to, like, regular, I'm driving my own product, I'm driving my own thing, we don't have this set of constraints for, like, an API?
I think today that it's still very much that is a different process, right? Like, I mean, in some ways there already is a spec for this out there that AI knows how to kind of follow and go through. I can think of a few internal projects that have existing shapes that we largely can do that with. But, you know, so many things that we do are just, they don't have comparables out there, right?
I'll like middle ground this one, which is I do think having the next test suite was a really good starting point. But now that we're into the territory of having to really make decisions about sort of more architectural things where maybe the surface area is the same, but like underneath the hood, what are we doing? Are we doing things optimally? Are we doing things that make sense for Vite and not things that make sense for TurboPack? Like it's almost like we've had to bring the human back in a little bit more in the loop, right? Where now we're actually having more discussions about like, okay, is this the right way to do it or not? And not just letting AI go wild at the test suite. So I definitely, if there's anything I've learned from this, it's that humans, in my opinion, aren't going anywhere in software development. But our role is going to change.
I still think there's going to be over the long term, I mean, more engineers, not less. We see people wanting to add engineers in our legal department, in our finance department. The number of places that you need engineers to do, you know, the thinking, the architecture. I met with a bunch of interns this morning, and I said, we talked about how what they do versus what someone came in 5 years ago is going to be different, right? I encourage them to work on their communication skills, their writing skills, their problem solving skills, as opposed to just expecting to be in front of a computer and taking a JIRA ticket and solving it. You have to be ready to do higher level things. But I think there's definitely going to be a role and a need for that.
Yeah, I mean, very little of my career has felt like I had a clearly scoped piece of work that I could just take a JIRA ticket off and like do it anyways. That always seemed like, I guess there were people doing that, but I'd always felt like that's weird. I've never had that experience like at work where it was just like, yeah, you just, here's the well-defined task that's obvious what it's going to do and how long it's going to take. Like, just go spend your time on that and come back to us later. Like that didn't, I don't know. For me, that was like not really part of any of my jobs after like year one of working. It felt like
I've had that happen once, and I realize now, like looking back on that, that's also the same thing that I did TDD with, is because it was so well defined that we had to sit down for so long to come up with it. There's like, oh, TDD also works in this situation, which probably highly aligns with this type of approach. It's like, oh, we already can build out all the constraints and the interface and everything, therefore everything just works. And now it's like, if I had AI back, then I could just said go now. All right. So I guess I kind of want to switch gears a little bit in the more interesting side of this discussion, which is the receiving of this, library slash, what do we call framework? I'm not really sure. I never know when to call. I don't want to, use the F word when people get really offended about it. I know it's or meta framework. It's an MF. It's an MF-er.
We do not say that on this podcast.
Not on
right?
this podcast. So with Mm-mm. that in mind, how was the receiving of it all? Because it's hard to kind of suss out what people actually feel when you just go on Twitter. And so I'm actually curious what that was like for you guys.
I can go. I honestly saw a lot of the Twitter stuff, but I tried not to pay too much attention to it. I think when we launched this, I actually like just turned off my phone and like went on a walk with my kids or something like that. I was like, I'm not going to pay attention to that the rest of the day. I want to build something that people like. That's it. At the end of the day, like I want to build software that's useful for people. So I've been very focused on like the people that are actually getting value out of this, right? I mean, Dane said, 50 plus contributors. I think at this point we've merged like 400 plus PRs in a month. I mean, this is like an active project. And so the reception in my mind has been really good because I see people using it and getting value out of it, right? And people outside of Cloudflare, to be clear, right? I mean, from day one, this has worked anywhere. It's just a Vite plugin. So you can Vite start and run it on any server in the world and it just works. So I think I've been very focused on that aspect of like, if I can make software that people enjoy using, then I'm going to keep doing that.
I mean, as you said, it does go back to the customers for us. I mean, obviously, I mentioned that it was the number of new users and new customers came that day was a huge spike. So that's gratifying. That people are using it and there's all different metrics on what could be success there. Number of active developers for us is really important. So that was a success from that. All the Twitter you know, it is what it is. It's, you know, it can be a little fun. It's short-lived, and you move on and get back to work, really.
I think the interesting thing here for me, too, about, like, the reception has been around, like, Vite, right? I mean, basically all the frameworks, except for Next, have standardized on Vite. I mean, I think that's just how it works now. And so you know, Next has sort of been telling everybody for years, like, well, we'll use TurboTax because we have to, because it's, you know, whatever, better or faster or all these things. And I think there's just been, like, this pent-up sort of latent sense of, like, well, what if you had just used Vite? And this answers that question. So when I built this, I definitely did not spend any time on performance or sort of, like, making build times fast. That was not what I was trying to do. I was trying to get the breadth of coverage with the API. So it's a testament to Vite that just literally the first version of this was 6 times faster, right? Like, that is, like, that's how powerful Vite is and how good it is as a bundler.
What Evan built, just the, you know, how many people have been able to build great things off of it. I mean, including, you know, Astro, right? This is really more of a story about how great Vite is, right? Like, none of this would be possible without that. Or, I mean, maybe it would have just, you know, been a lot more tokens. But, you know, I think the fact that a design like that has been able to kind of get you the ubiquity and still remain performant and it's pretty amazing.
We've got, I would say, like a wide range of devs that watch the pod. Can you explain to people who are not in the web dev world, why is there a thing called Vite?
And then why is and also why don't people use Vite and they use other things?
Oh, I thought for sure you were going to say, and why isn't it pronounced Vite?
It is
I threw that up for you, Prime, because I knew that was your one, and then you didn't even go
I'm
for it.
I'm trying to
That's
be polite.
It's a little weak,
It's
dude.
Clearly Vite. Okay, keep on going.
It's funny you ask this question for, like, people who don't understand, like, web dev, and then I'm, like, do we have an hour for me to spend talking about, like, the history of bundling on the web? Because
you must start like, with Grunt, and then I want to...
Okay.
You gotta go back to Grunt, Browserify, Gulp.
I would love to start with Grunt.
Listen, I will die on the hill for Gulp. Gulp was one of the greatest build tools of all time, and I will die on that hill.
I agree with Dylan. Dylan is correct about this.
I don't understand why
was a revolution.
We can't just use Make for all this, to be quite honest.
There's a group of people that agree with that.
I still use
now
Make.
We're cooking.
I do have
now
a hot take
cooking.
About Make. I think Make is overutilized in developer ecosystems outside of web dev, and severely underutilized in web dev. That's my Make hot take.
All right, so for those that have no idea
you
what
didn't
Vite
have, you
is...
You didn't want to follow up on the hot take,
project? No, we're not, because we are so far
okay.
off. We need...
Okay.
People are still...
Sorry.
Like, 3/4 of our audience are going to be like, okay, so what is Vite, and why do they keep talking about Gulp when I asked them about Vite? It's a very confusing...
Okay, that's what I'm saying. People actually don't know.
I will do my best to do this. Okay, so when you build a web application, you have things that need to all get bundled together and deployed, right? So you have your HTML, your CSS, and your JavaScript, right? Papered over like 10 other things, but like, let's just say most of it is that. Now you need something that understands all of these things and the relationships between them, and then is capable of basically emitting something that is just, here's your deployable site and you can deploy it to the internet on anywhere and it'll just work, right? So over the years, there have been many takes on this and many iterations, and things come and replace the thing before it. And the last big thing was Webpack, right? So Webpack for a long time was sort of the king, and everybody was like, okay, you use Webpack to take your raw source files and turn it into something that is optimized to be an actual website, right? If we deployed raw source files to the web, we would have all kinds of problems, right? Which there's people that think you should just do that, but we're gonna like ignore those people for a second.
Let's go DHH. So, all right, keep going, sorry, keep going.
So then Webpack has got, you know, again, I'm sort of like offending people left or right. There are people that think Webpack got slow and, you know, it was hard to configure and had all these problems, right? And so there was a next generation of things that kind of decided to try to replace Webpack. There's things like Parcel, RSpack, various things. Vite is one of those things, and Vite, and again, I'm going to just sort of like blanket statement this, kind of just won. Right. So Vite is the underpinning bundler for most frameworks today. I would actually say any popular framework besides Next.js uses Vite. Now, what Next did was build their own thing in Rust called TurboPack that they saw as like a spiritual successor to Webpack. I think one of the original Webpack maintainers is very involved in TurboPack. And so they sort of had their own take on what this has looked like, but nobody else ended up using it besides Next. And so that is where Vite comes into the picture. And so there's been this like sort of very simple fork in the ecosystem of whether you use Next and TurboPack or whether you use some other framework and use Vite. Or you just use Vite by itself. Vite is actually very capable on its own. You don't need a framework. You can just like use Vite. It has very good sort of primitives and APIs. You can just deploy a React app on Vite and it works really well.
Would that make it a meta framework?
I mean,
where's that MF talk?
Yeah, we only have one rule, Dane, and you broke it. We don't say that word here, okay?
To put it, maybe help color some people's perspective, if you have a language that was invented beyond 2008, you typically, the language itself also provided all the tooling. So Go has its own tooling, Rust has its own tooling, Zig has its own tooling, and all that. Some of the older languages, you don't get all the tooling kind of also thrown into it, so it gets really complicated. Everyone knows about, you know, Java. Java was very, very difficult back in the day. C is very, very difficult. As you get huge build systems devoted to it, and JavaScript is the exact same thing. There is no, you know, committee that owns the web, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. These are all individually, you know, developed items, all falling under the W3 consortium and some NTC39. Multiple things are all doing it, and so
they get a lot of stuff done fast.
Yeah, so that means tools. There's not like a department of tools, so everyone kind of makes up their own tool, and then some of them got popular. There, in fact, was even Snowpack at one time, which I think got renamed to Parcel, potentially. I can't remember. But there's been a lot of bundling in the web world.
If we just make a new one, do you think everyone will use ours then?
Yeah. If there's a small chance, TJ.
I fully support it. So
just one more framework, bro. Just one more framework.
If you do that, I will fork vNext, and then I will rewrite vNext in the new thing.
V even Nexter.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, we have to change the prefix, right? Because the VI for it is for Vite, I'm assuming, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it'd be XNX. We XNade. There we go. All right, so how about some of the sentiment? Like, did you have any uphill battles in the sentiment change, or was there enough social pressure that you had to – did you feel any of it? Like, not just like, hey, we put our heads down, we moved on, we had a great customer day. Was there any fires you had to put out or things you had to take a little bit more time on kind of explaining your positioning?
So I mean, we have a ton of respect for the Next.js team. We're working with them closely. A blog recently came out about Next adapters that we helped work with the team on. I mean, they built a great product. I mean, the testament to just the number of developers that use it. Mm-hmm. Obviously my tweet with a little tongue in cheek, it was not meant to offend anyone. We do have that huge respect. So, you know, we did spend a lot of time with the team and making sure that, you know, they knew we were committed to both the Next adapters and that we are going to be still committed to that because we've been working with them on that. And we're still very excited for that to come. I mean, and Steve and his team and Fred from the Astro team all spent a lot of time with them on that. And we think they're doing, you know, great work with the adapters and, a lot of this is how open source works. Like, when adapters gets there, obviously, then, you know, maybe we'll just support Vite Next and Pure Next. As opposed to also, there's a whole other thing we haven't been talking about, OpenNext. I think the pressures and forking is how you kind of push back innovation when there's not, complete community support for the direction that you want to take something in.
All right. And then I did want to talk a little bit more. I know, TJ, you kind of alluded to it earlier, kind of about this whole, like, using AI on a purely on the project. Has there been any downsides, besides for some sloppification, has there been any downsides or things that you're finding frustrating in this more purely AI approach to building something that is largely customer-facing?
I mentioned sloppification. I would say sometimes I just feel like I'm a little babysitting everything too much, right? I've got like maybe 10 different workspaces going and they're all kind of going along in the background, and then I'm losing track of what's doing what, and then I go check in on it, and I'm like, oh, like, what did you do here? You know, you just went down some weird path. And so it definitely feels like right now I'm sort of this glorified AI babysitter, and I want to believe that, like, as these agents get better, the agents can do more of their babysitting for themselves. But right now it feels very much like I still have to be, like, sitting there, like, minding them every day.
I hope it's not how you describe managing your own team, Steve.
it's sort of interesting because, like, I gave a talk at an event in SF about this and sort of the contrasting the difference between managing humans and managing AI. I mean, AI is better at taking feedback than humans are, right? I mean, you can just tell an AI it did a bad job and it won't get mad at you, right? but also, like, so somebody asked me, they were like, oh, you know, is your management skills translate? And I said, not really, right? Like, I mean, humans are, like, squishier, right? And we need, like, sort of more, like, thoughtful feedback. And AI, you can just kind of say, like, this sucks, just do it again, right? You know, and it'll just do it again. So it's been interesting. There's a less overlap there than I thought there would be.
We were just laughing about this recently. Prime and I were working on something, and he, like, told, like, hey, move this thing to the left, and then it did it. And he's like, no, put it back on top. And I'm like, oh, I'm just imagining if it was a person on the other end and you're, like, yelling at some junior dev and it's like, move the couch over an inch to the left, no, your other left kind of situation. But the AI doesn't care at all. It'll just, okay, I'll put it back on top, no problem.
It's interesting to see the range of outcomes, right? Like if somebody writes a document for me and you know, I say, okay, this isn't very good, you need to make it better, you know, maybe it'll get a little better, right? But somebody's not going to, like, rewire their brain overnight. But AI really kind of can, you know. You can literally say, like, no, this is entirely wrong, start over, and it can do something entirely different, which it's hard for them to make that level of adjustment in relative to feedback. So it's a bit rambly, but, like, there's like, I don't have a takeaway other than I'm still trying to figure it out too. Right.
There's this kind of process where, you know, they say that writing, like, how you write is how you kind of express your opinions or how you think through stuff. Like, it's kind of like one of the big signs of intelligence is your ability to write out your thoughts, because you have to organize them and actually go through stuff. Without the actual activeness of programming and then a lot of more and more feedback about, say, the interfaces and all of that, of how you interface with stuff, kind of just also just being vibed out where people can't really actively know what the interfaces are, maybe you're not as familiar with them because a lot of it is vibed out. How do you kind of come up with better ways to work when these layers are becoming more and more fuzzy because you don't look at them every day? You kind of look at them, well, we can all agree we look at them less than we ever would, say, 5 years ago. So how do you know that you're even building the right direction at this point without, like, that constant, daily, everyday thinking about it, like, in the trenches, not just from a high-level view?
That's where, like, experience probably comes in, right? Like, I'm almost at a bit of an advantage there, where I've been in this space and working on these problems for so long that I have a lot of strong opinions about what should be done and how it should be done. Even if I'm not writing code every day, right? Like, it hasn't been my job for a while, but I still have opinions about the JavaScript ecosystem and how things should be working, right? And so there has been times where the AI will happily go off and build something that is wrong if you just let it. And we've had that happen on this project. And then I have to step in and say, like, no. I am 100% sure that we should do it this way because I have, you know, 15 years of experience that tells me that's the way we should do it. All right. And that's where, honestly, some of the other people who've been involved in the project, I think, have, you know, like, we have some fantastic contributors, but I think there's been a couple cases where they've just went and built a thing because somebody asked for it, or AI just said, oh, just do it this way. And they don't have that, like, depth of experience to say, like, no, this is wrong, we're not going to do it this way.
How do you think people are going to get that experience, in the future?
I think about this a lot, and I don't know the answer, right? Like,
I have thoughts on this. I have a more mid-level junior dev on my team.
Oh, sorry, we're out of time.
So we have a mid-level junior dev on our team, and, like, I mean, Prime and I talked about this when we were in San Francisco for probably 30, 45 minutes. Like, I think it's a real fear because, like, how do you learn this stuff without, like, just struggling through it and making mistakes over and over and over again? But, like, the process I've been finding working, one is, like, we've been doing, like, we'll have, like, I mean, the whole team is, like, basically leaned into, like, agentic programming, right? But, like, what we'll do is we'll push a plan or a spec PR up first, like, literally just the markdown document that somebody on the team iterated on, and you know, they know the feature they need to want, and then we'll review that markdown document, like NPR, humans doing normal code review. And this has been like, I think this has been a really good way for knowledge transfer, because like with experience, you can see one, like you can just know, especially like when you've done enough like agentic programming, like you know where the clanker is going to go off the rails. You know where GPT-5.4 is going to go write some stupid is record or normalized function.
Bro, it loves his record.
Dude, normalized is crazy too.
I literally have lint rules blocking it.
I'm pretty sure Sammy pre-trained it with that to get a few extra tokens on every request. That's my hypothesis.
I will put my tinfoil hat on and agree.
That's what I'm saying.
But like in that case, like you can also start picking apart the architecture better and like using that to refine it. So like when more junior devs go to implement features, that they're going to have a higher degree of success because you've looked over it architecturally. And like I also like don't know if I agree with the stance that we should be thinking about and looking at our like interfaces and APIs less. Like if anything, that's where I'm spending way more of my time. Like I try to break work down really, really tiny, and I start at like the interface level. And I actually think like, shout out OCaml, like thinking in terms of like modular programming, and shout out like one module per file operating over a primary type, get the interfaces really, really good and strong, and then leave the implementation up to the clanker to go build. Like that seems to work really, really well for me.
Yeah, I've done a lot recently with just saying like, you will never suggest a change to me that doesn't show like the interface. I don't care if you put like ... in the middle of the function and you're saying like, this part's fine, you can do whatever you want in the middle, but like if we can constrain it well, like on the outside with the types, we can get very far. And usually like it's much more apparent to me like from the get go what's gonna go wrong. It still seems difficult for me to figure out how someone would get some of those skills, though only through prompting. Like I've actually been toying with the idea of just like doing, whether it's like in the same project or a different project, just like all the way, no tab completion, nothing, like for a set amount of hours every week. Like that's what I would definitely recommend for someone who hasn't written like a lot of hours of code already, is thinking about like, hey, for some amount of time every week, you should just go write some code by hand and like figure it out and find out what's painful and what does and doesn't work, even if it's part of a bigger project.
I do it actually every morning, like for an hour and a half. I do that every morning.
Yeah.
There's also this, I stumbled upon it on Twitter a couple weeks ago. It's like, I think it's called Bloomery, and it's like this blog post. I think it's called From Ore to Iron. And they have like this skill, like an agent skill. And this skill, once you load it, walks you through handwriting like an actual agent from scratch, like step by step. And like I think there's like a really good use case here where like you could have more principal engineers or DevRels or somebody constructing, like maybe like you're working on a team that's working on a giant Astro project or a giant Next.js project, and like teaching the skills through that way might be useful. I also agree with you guys. Like, I don't know how you pick up these skills and intuitions without having like handwritten and screwed up and caused incidents and outages and or seeing things go right over the years. So like, it almost feels like it's more like a more than ever like a trade thing where like stuff has to be passed down more like intentionally than we have before.
So my early programming days were Ruby, like the heyday of like pair programming, doing like katas, like TDD. I had a mentor who basically sat me down one day and was like, we're only going to write tests today, and you're just going to have to deal with this, and you're going to like sit there and learn. And like, now I don't TDD anymore, right? Like not how I like to program, but I learned the value of what it was and when to apply it and when it made sense to do it. And I was like forced to do that by somebody. And I sort of wonder if we're going to have to do that same thing with some juniors, right?
Do you think the world can even handle that at this point? Because it seems like, based on Twitter, everyone's producing 10,000 lines of code a day. Like, can they actually satiate this? I don't think it's like a when you program, you have this experience where you actually feel like you're doing things. Like, it's very entertaining. There's like problem solving, there's putting together stuff, whereas prompting, I do, at least personally, I get significantly less of that, but it's a lot easier. And so can people even slow themselves down enough to practice the base skill at this point? Or is it too hard to convince someone, like, no, you got to stop being productive in your version of it and actually just go out there and hand cut down a tree for a little bit?
I mean, I think we're in the early days. I mean, right now, I mean, the euphoria, the dopamine hit that you're getting right now, just like early COVID days, the productivity gains, you know, everyone was getting, you know, it won't be sustainable. I think, you know, people will have to kind of, it'll go back to a kind of a more of a midpoint at some point where there is a better balance.
It does feel good. It's like playing slots right now sometimes, you know what I mean? Like, I don't gamble in my real life, but I'm willing to do a little bit of gambling on some coding, you know what I mean? You pull the slot. Did it come out with something sick? Did it update the page right? Ooh, it did. It hit. It's good. It's coming up sevens. So I think there is something actually, like, very, like, underexplored about that aspect of, like, how people feel when they're doing, like, agentic stuff. It turns out, like, loot boxes are really fun. That's why every game has them. So, like, then they're making a lot of money off the loot box spin and a sparkle coming out. So it's like, I don't know what I think. Actually, this is I think developers think that we're super rational beings who only pick stuff based on rational reasons. But then if you know any software developers, are like, oh, they're not actually that rational. A lot of stuff's based off vibes and, like, how they feel. And, like, they met someone that they liked who said this, so then they like this thing too, which is fine. That's me. You know, like, I just recognize, like, a lot of what I do is off of vibes. Met a cool – someone cool told me OCaml was cool, and I was like, sick. I love OCaml. But so I think, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, I would never get tricked by loot boxes. And then you're like, bro, you're loot boxing so hard right now with your agents.
There is something about that. I have to say that because yeah. I've forcefully put in my life a 100% vibe coded thing just to, like, feel the slot machine to understand how far I can take things to really try to quote unquote hone these skill issues that I always have. And a part of that, I realized that when I see the reds and greens fly real fast, like when Composer 2 is going fast, like, there's part of me that gets like, oh yeah, dude, that's exciting. Like, look at this go. This is going to be a good change. Here we go. Good change. And then sometimes it's not a good change. It's frustrating. It's very interesting.
But when it hits, man, when it hits, it's like Disney World. The whole day at Disney World isn't good. We have the highest highs, right? You know, that's what I'm saying. Disney World sets it up that way too. They don't care that most of the day sucks and you waited in line. It's just about five magical moments with your kids, and that's how they make $1 trillion a year. I don't know how much Disney World makes. Don't quote me on that, guys.
They make a lot.
Turkey leg and a Dole Whip. I'm just like, I'm good to go. I'm happy camper for the rest of the day.
Exactly. It's a Small World comes on, and you're like, well, that's not leaving my head for 6 weeks.
All right. Well, we're about to run out of time with you guys. I know you guys are on tight schedule. So is there any last takes that you could give us on, say, how you rolled this out, any takeaways, things you would have changed?
Any blockers,
any ways you'd, any things forward, however direction you want to take them?
I'll say, like, the best thing you can do is go try it and use AI, right? Like, when we've been very upfront about that. The README, the first thing in the README is, like, quick start, migrate to VNext, put it into your Clanker, right? Like, that's what we want you to do, right? It's, again, AI everywhere, AI end-to-end. And then if you hit problems, tell your AI to go file GitHub issues about those problems and explain that. Like, that some of the best feedback we've gotten so far has been exactly with that dynamic. I kind of tell people, like, if you're a human and you just want to, like, try this out as a human, like, you might just not have the best time because it's not really designed for you, right? It's designed for this new world. So please try it out. Please use your AI to do it and tell us the problems.
Can we have a 1.0 by July 4th?
Oh, 1.0 July 4th. Dane just asked me, like, when are we doing 1.0? And I was like, yeah. Like a month or two.
Well, I put him on the spot now.
Let's commit on the podcast right
this
now.
This is the stand-up right now. We need to know when is the release date.
I'm blocked.
July 4th, 1.0.
Dang, I love exactly. America Day. That sounds awesome.
250 years of America, baby.
Can you turn off Cloudflare support to the UK on that day also? Like, really celebrate America?
It's available everywhere, except the for the UK. It's hilarious. That's good, Brian. That's good.
It's a marketing strategy, you know? Really get people excited.
Oh, that's good. I like that. We need to do
We do have to do maintenance on physical machines every once in a while. Maybe that day, just, you know, some of our UK
What a weird coincidence. Cool. What a weird coincidence. All right. Dylan, any blockers?
I am currently blocked on all my work by Trash Dev. I'm a little disappointed he wasn't here to work that out.
You're waiting on the receipts app or what? Like,
yeah, I just like, I can't, he's got to get his stuff together. My advice to everyone is slow down, make tiny changes with your agents, review everything. Don't just throw mountains of code at your coworkers, and try Pi agent.
As a quick post-mortem, is that what you did after you deleted all of the code while we were on stream in San Francisco?
I don't remember that ever happening.
Yeah, I just remember 80,000.
Josh, get the clip. Josh, we have it on video. You're in trouble.
Mr. Slowdown over here.
Oh, yes. And also Righto Camel.
Oh,
for sure.
Based. Nice, nice.
Dane, anything you got to say?
I mean, step away from the agents, have fun. Have fun with your team. I mean, we still live in a world fit full of humans. And, you know, the best part of my job is actually getting to work with people like Dylan and Steve. So, you know, don't forget the humans.
Prime, any blockers?
Just image loading in OBS. Got to figure that out.
Oh, yeah. I actually, believe it or not, I tried to open your slop fork or just your slop repo, and it didn't run at all in my machine. And it had a Postgres composer up, but it said it was running SQLite. So we'll follow up with that offline. We'll parking lot that.
Yeah, parking lot that.
I don't have any blockers. I'm just ready for this episode to end.
All right.
All right. Thank you, guys.
That is the stand up. Thank you, TJ, for that lovely ending. Thank you, Dylan. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Dane, for joining us. I hope everybody appreciated this. This was very interesting. Because this is like really the first major project that is out there for a lot of people to use that is going to be purely AI driven. So, all right.
Bye, everybody.
Boot up today. Vibe coding. Errors on my screen. Terminal coffee. And hair.